When I was growing up, my family didn't do bad news. My maternal grandmother responded to everything from family squabbles to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict by declaring cheerfully, "I'm sure they'll work it out." There are worse things for a child to endure than relentless optimism. My plight wasn't even unique. Lots of middle-class Americans grow up in sunny, non-introspective homes. But I suspect that mine was more relentlessly positive than most. In order to avoid unpleasant subjects, we didn't go into much detail about anything, including our own ancestry. I was nearly a teenager when I discovered that two of my grandparents and all of my great-grandparents came to America as immigrants, mostly from Russia. Since no one had said otherwise, I'd assume we'd been Americans forever. Even our immigration story was vague. My grandmother said her parents came from a place called Minsky Gubernia, but she didn't know exactly where this was, and when she once searched the Ellis Island records, there was no trace of either of them. And after her family settled in South Carolina, they instantly went native. My grandmother became a Southern belle and a sorority sister who lived by the local maxim, "If you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything." No one in my family ever mentioned that we had close relatives who stayed behind in Minsky Gubernia. When I eventually questioned my grandmother about this, she acknowledged that her mother used to send care packages of dried beans and clothing to siblings and cousins who'd remained in Russia. But after World War II, she didn't send them packages anymore. "We lost touch," my grandmother said. This is how my family explained the fate of relatives who were probably rounded up and murdered in the Holocaust. "We lost touch." This extreme positivity seemed to run in my maternal line, with each generation shielding the next from bad news. I first noticed it at my father's 40th birthday party when I was 6. We were celebrating at home in Miami, the city where I grew up. Guests were having drinks on the patio around our swimming pool. I was in the house when I heard a splash and saw a commotion. "What happened?" I asked my mother. "Nothing happened," she assured me. For the record, my mother was loving, warm, and well-intentioned. She was trying to protect me. But I suspect I'd be a different person today, perhaps working in a different profession, had she simply said, "Larry Goodman got drunk and fell in the pool." Then we could have agreed that bad things sometimes happen and that I was a reliable witness of them. Instead, I came to feel that bad things occur in a fuzzy, far-off dimension, always patio distance away. If you don't examine them too closely, it's as if they never happened. This view of life was easy to sustain in Miami. The city is perpetually sunny and was literally invented out of air, since it only started to boom once air conditioning became widely available in the 1950s and 60s. Years later, when my future in-laws visited one of Miami's oldest homes, now part of a historic state park, they pointed out that it was roughly the same age as their house in London. People are often surprised to hear that I spent my childhood in Miami. They think it's a city of grandparents, but that's mostly Miami Beach, a slender island off the city's eastern coast. There's a whole other hot, unglamorous inland area where most inhabitants live. My parents bought their first home on land that had previously been a mango grove. The mango trees were still there, and the fruits would splatter on our cars, ruining the paint. Like the other homes in the neighborhood, ours was concrete, air-conditioned, and built to keep out the salamanders, the burglars, and the weather. Occasionally, a black ringneck snake would slither inside through the vents. We almost never saw the beach. Practically everyone in Miami was displaced. Our Cuban neighbors were certain that they would soon be returning to Havana. Most of my parents' friends had Brooklyn or tri-state accents. We pretended that South Florida had the same seasons as New York, though in department store photographs of me with Santa Claus, I'm tanned and wearing shorts. Miami's lack of context and aura of wishful thinking suited us perfectly. When my mother had to disclose any unpleasant news, say that someone we knew had cancer, she'd sandwich it between reports of dinner plans and cheerleading practice. The bad news would flash by so quickly, I doubt whether I'd really heard it. It was the 1980s and the peak of the American divorce boom, so I'd often learned that grown-ups I knew were splitting up, but never the reasons why. My parents didn't say much about people they knew or describe relationships between our family members. I once noticed them whispering about an alcoholic aunt, but when I asked for details, they went silent. I learned years later that the aunt would launch into anti-Semitic rants after her first Bloody Mary. Such facts weren't considered child-friendly. In fact, almost nothing was. We described world events, new outfits, and summer vacations with vague catchphrases like, "It's terrible," "That looks adorable," and "We had the best time." People we approved of were fabulous. One of my mother's friends liked to call pretty women delicious. Those we didn't like were annoying. Someone who spoke about any one subject for too long was boring or not regular. I would later realize that these boring people were the semi-intellectuals in our midst. My parents weren't my only source of information, of course. I knew about AIDS, political prisoners, and the fact that Colombian drug cartels murdered people in Miami. I read books in which characters had backstories, contradictory qualities, and inner lives. But as an obedient oldest child, I also believed that what happened at home was real life. And in our house, we didn't gather facts into patterns, analyze our own experiences, or speculate about other people. Nor did we discuss our own history, ethnicity, or social class. Pointing out complicated truths just made everyone uncomfortable. It was like saying that Larry Goodman fell in the pool.